Elise Glink joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch to talk about Amazon, which, by the way, Elise, I don't know I would have guessed was the second largest employer in the state of Illinois. According to Elise Glink's newsletter, Amazon, the world's second largest private employer, I'm reading her writing, may be running out of people to hire. An internal research memo obtained by Recode indicated that the e-commerce giant is worried its available U.S. warehouse labor will deplete very soon. Amazon is, it's funny because not only does everybody buy everything from Amazon, everybody works for Amazon. And the available labor force for Amazon is reaching a limit. Amazon has downplayed the implications of the research memo. It's an internal memo, saying it does not represent what's really going on, they say. But even if the company is not on the cusp of a labor shortage, it is struggling with attrition as employees raise concerns about unsafe working environments. I'm reading your writing, and this is very good, Elise.
Can you hear me, John?
Oh, you sound great now.
Oh, good. So the story is so interesting, especially we're in this crazy environment right now where we have tons of jobs available. People are still switching. I'm getting emails every day about people finding new jobs, and yet Amazon has looked out and its economists and researchers have taken a look at the number of people available to take a job with Amazon, even at $18 or $20 an hour, and they realize that the supply is actually limited. And that's just a remarkable thing given that we seem to be heading towards a recession.
Point being what?
Well, that they are going to have to, they've already been on the leading edge. They've raised their minimum wage to $18 an hour on average, but they're going to have to go even higher than that if they want to get people away. The competitors for the type of workers who work in their warehouses, they're also raising their wages. So they're competing against Walmart, they're competing against fast food companies, they're competing against other logistics and shipping organizations. And so the company right now has plenty of people to work, but as they continue to spread out all over the U.S., they said that the U.S. warehouse labor supply will actually dry out. And that's given that they've already grew their global workforce at 75% during the pandemic, and 70% of their retail business is in the U.S.
It seems to me, tell me if this sounds about right to you, I don't know that Amazon's Q score is all that great. People don't seem to love the company. They love the site and they buy things from Amazon. So everybody loves to have the truck pull up and the stuff arrive at their door. But I don't think that the owner of the company or the company itself is that quote unquote popular. Maybe it's not even a great place to work. Does that sound about right?
Well, I think that there's mixed feelings is a good way to put it. But when you think about the 36,000 Amazon workers in Illinois, like, where are they? Well, you've got full-time and part-time people at 20 fulfillment centers. A whole bunch have gone up. 20 delivery stations and 28 Whole Foods stores.
Oh, yeah, right.
Other locations, right? Those are all Amazon workers. And so I think different pieces of the company are happier than others, perhaps. But where this is all headed, John, the only way to solve their labor problem for the long term is to find more ways for robots to take over some of the tougher parts of those warehouse jobs and to automate a lot of the rest of the chain of the logistics so that people aren't getting worn out walking 10 miles a day from end to end in their warehouses.
Well, and that's maybe what I was wondering is, so what has Amazon done anything wrong here? Maybe, in fact, warehouse work is not that fulfilling or it's very demanding and there's other jobs out there these days. So while it's easy to say, oh, boo to the company, we don't like Amazon, and maybe they're not doing anything wrong per se. It's just the place that we're in at this time. I want you to talk more about that. And there's a few other things in this memo that I need you to comment on. Elise Glink is on a line, and you can always follow her at thinkglink.com. And she's the host of This Week in Wealth with Tom Fortino, Sundays at 6:30 in the morning, where they talk about wealth. Talk more, Elise, about this memo at Amazon.
Well, you know, what Amazon is basically saying, you know, they're the world's second largest private employer. They are the second largest, or they may even be the largest employer in the state of Illinois. They're right up there with Aurora Advocate Health System. And the concern, you know, that their own people have, and this was a memo that was obtained by Recode, Recode found out that they're actually worried that the number of people who could work with the U.S. Warehouse labor force, that the number of people available to work in their warehouses would actually deplete sometime over the next year or so. And in fact, the memo said 2024, but of course, you know, the question is, you know, can they raise wages? Would that help? They're probably trying to do some of that. They're also having an issue with unionization, and they don't want people to unionize. They feel like they offer a tremendous amount of wages and benefits, but the unionization push, union push is getting to be pretty strong at Amazon, and at a number of places they've actually been able to unionize. So it's interesting to watch how this is actually playing out. And as we talked about just before the break, you know, it isn't just warehouse places that Amazon's having, you know, an issue. They also have 28 Whole Food grocery stores just in Chicago, in the state of Illinois, I should say. And so there are lots of different kinds of jobs at Amazon, and they are growing very, very quickly.
Do people talk about this in terms of immigration at all? I mean, I don't know if what the flow is of people coming into this country, but I wonder if increasing that or making it easier for people to work here would alleviate some of these problems. I don't know.
It's possible. I mean, the jobs are good ones, you know, $18 an hour with full benefits, you know, and a lot of other, you know, pluses. They're now paying for people to go back and continue their education. They're paying that in full. There's other kinds of things that are packed in. I know as the CEO of Best Money Moves, my financial wellness company, we've talked to Amazon and their partners about including even more financial well-being into that platform. So they're trying hard on their side to put together a benefits package, a complete benefits package, that with the addition of higher pay would actually speak to employees. There's just not enough employees to go around right now, which is kind of interesting. But the airlines are having the same issue, John. If you look at, you know, just all of the cancellations this weekend, it isn't really weather that's killing all the planes. It's really they don't quite have the number of pilots that they need. A lot of people retired during the pandemic, and they don't have enough pilots in the pipeline to come in. And so the bigger planes have now upped the income, or I should say the pay for pilots by, in some cases, 75%, so that they can get them to switch and come work for them. And that's leaving the smaller airlines, you know, the ones that are three seats across and two seats across, right? The RJs and whatever. Those smaller airlines and smaller airplanes are having trouble now getting pilots because those have all been pulled into the larger ones.
You go work for United.
Exactly. It's been really interesting interesting to watch. And meanwhile, you know, the other thing I sent you today is that the Breeze, which is the digital disability insurance company, they released a survey on Friday of 2,000 people who are apparently terrified of inflation and rising costs. So getting the bump in terms of your salary is good, but it's not quelling the financial stress and the anxiety on the other side as people are starting to pull back. And so what Breeze found is that 88% of consumers have cut back on spending because of inflation.
Brenda did some shopping over the weekend because everybody gathered at our place and we cooked a lot of food. And Brenda came in with the groceries and she said, I saw it. I'm really feeling it. I mean, because we had to buy a lot of groceries. And so it was going to be a lot of money anyway, but it was a lot of money and then some. You know, on a weekend like this, you sort of really felt the weight of inflation, you know?
Well, it's if you want to cook red meat, you just whatever kind of red meat it is, it doesn't even matter if it's just hamburger meat. You know, there's enough of a difference now at the store that if you are feeding a lot of people, you are going to have a huge pinch. And let alone, you know, cost me over $100 to fill up my gas tank this week. I was doing a lot of trips to downtown Chicago. I think you're going to start to see more people take public transportation. I was in Denver last week for meetings, and I went to go call an Uber to go to the airport for my last meeting, and it was $150 in the middle of the day.
From
no
where?
Traffic,
wait,
nothing.
From where to where?
Downtown Denver to the airport, which admittedly
it's on
like
the other, yeah.
It's 35-40 miles, but that trip should be, you know, like under $70, and it was $150.
Wow.
And you know what I did, John? I took the train, and it was $10.
Well, shoot. Of course, airplane tickets are expensive now, too, but Chicago to Denver in the not-too-distant past, you could have done that for a couple $100, and then the ride to the airport would rival the cost of the flight. That's crazy.
It is. And so Sam and I were looking to book a trip to the West Coast, to Seattle, to go do a little hiking in the mountains. And the cheapest airfare we could find for August, so well over, you know, a month away from now, is close to $1,000 per person.
And you're flying in August?
We wanted to fly in August. We decided not to. We decided we would not do that, and instead we would find something else to do around Chicago that we could drive to.
Give me one last number. I got about a minute left here, Elise, on this Breeze report. What else are they saying about inflation?
Well, they're saying that 75% of people, to the, you know, Brenda's point, are worried about providing food for themselves and families. 93% are intentionally driving less to save gas money. I heard that, by the way, all the way in Denver. 87% have canceled vacation plans.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's maybe the mirror, not surprising, but if you're struggling with some of those things, you're certainly not alone. Elise Glink is the owner of Think Link Media and Best Money Moves, and she's the co-host of This Week in Wealth with Tom Fortino. You hear that here on WGN Radio, Sundays at 6:30 a.m., thinklink.com. Talk next week. Thanks, Elise.
You bet, John.
Jim Dahlke joins us. You hear him regularly on the Business Lunch, the senior editor. It's Chicago Inno. Jim, can we start with this piece that you just published, or maybe it hasn't been published yet, about a Chicagoan named Landon Campbell?
Yeah, hey, John, that's right. So Landon, really interesting, young, up-and-coming techie in the Chicago startup ecosystem. He's got a new podcast that actually launched a couple years ago. It's called In Their 20s. A really interesting take here on the interview podcast. Of course, there's no shortage of podcasts out there that are interviewing successful, famous people. And certainly in the business world, there's a ton of podcasts you can find where you can hear business folks kind of talk about their career and advice and tips. But the focus of In Their 20s is exactly as the title sounds. It's a focus with influential folks about their 20s, what it was like when in their 20s, what was their career like then, what was their life like then, and advice for other people in their 20s. I really kind of love the angle that he's picked here. And the podcast has really taken off. So Landon Campbell has interviewed folks like Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, NBA legend Tim Hardaway, the mayor of Miami, Ev Williams, the co-founder of Twitter. The podcast is approaching 100 episodes, actually just eclipsed that mark recently. And so really kind of a who's who of professional business folks who agreed to chat with Landon about, you know, what their 20s were like and what lessons they've learned and passing some advice on to folks today. So really interesting podcast that's grown really quickly from a Chicagoan.
How does a 24-year-old without a mainstream platform get those people to talk to him on a podcast, for crying out loud?
I know. It's a great question. And really, it's you know, a testament to his own hustle, right? So, I mean, like you would imagine, the podcast starts with people in his network. And then He said slowly but surely, people started to reach out to him to get involved. And then now all of a sudden, it's catching on to the point where PR firms are pitching their business clients to be involved. So really, you know, he was just trying to get into the inbox of every, you know, sort of influential business person that he could find early on, and then the network has just sort of spread from there. But yeah, I mean, you know, one takeaway from the podcast, something that he's learned a lot, is that, you know, there's no one path to success. You know, like all these different successful people have charted different ways, college, no college. You know, there's not just sort of one route to success in business and in life. And I think the people he talks to kind of tell that story.
It's funny because a concept of the last few years has been the failure to launch. People in their 20s, maybe even 30s, who haven't seemed to get to that next phase in their life or career. I wonder what this 20-something and these other 20-somethings say about that concept, you know?
Yeah, failure is a big piece of it. He said that that's something that a lot of the guests are mentioning on the podcast, right? Like, you know, we don't take that the leap of faith because we're, you know, we're scared we're going to fail, which, you know, Landon says it is, you know, failure itself, right? So not, you know, being too afraid to do something is failure in and of itself. And so, you know, he sort of encourages, you know, the folks who are tuning in and listening to these successful business leaders and athletes and other famous folks is to just don't be afraid to take that step. And so it's a good lesson for all of us.
Landon Campbell. And what's the name of the podcast then?
The name of the podcast is In Their 20s.
After record growth for startups in 2021, are the boom years over? That's a headline of yours. What's the answer to that?
Yeah, so this is from a report from a group called Startup Genome. Every year they do a big worldwide ranking of startup ecosystems. And Chicago came in number 8 in the United States and the 19th best ecosystem across the world. Chicago had a major year last year. We've every Monday kind of talking about what the year of 2021 was like in Chicago for the tech and startup ecosystem. Just a massive boom year in terms of the number of companies reaching billion-dollar valuations, the number of capital coming into the area. The major, major funding rounds have kind of made Chicago elevate up the ladder, right? So Chicago kind of outpacing cities like Denver, Austin, Atlanta, Miami, Dallas. Still coming behind some cities like Silicon Valley, New York, Boston, L.A., Seattle, D.C., San Diego. So still some ways to go. But, you know, the backdrop of the report is that cities like Chicago and across the country and the world are kind of preparing for a bit of a slowdown. We've talked about this before as well, but, you know, the tech markets are getting hammered right now, and that trickles its way down to the startup world, especially when it comes to venture capital raise and potential IPOs. And so we are, after a very, very robust year in 2021, startup cities, especially Chicago, are bracing for a bit of a slowdown.
Flex Fridays, are techs trying this? And if so, how is it going? And what is Flex Friday anyway?
Yeah, so, you know, the whole concept of a summer Friday is not exactly new. You know, lots of companies during the summer months have sort of been a little bit flexible with their Friday schedules with employees, whether it's jetting off to the coast a little bit early. You know, we started to see that a little last year in Chicago's tech ecosystem. And this year, a company called Basis Technology, which is an ad tech firm, originally called Centro, they're actually planning to IPO at some point, potentially later this year. They have a new policy, like you mentioned, called Flex Fridays. It's letting their employee base of nearly 1,000 employees log off early on Friday. So at noon on Friday, you are officially off the clock at Basis Technology. So this is a little bit of a policy they're piloting here this summer, which they think that they could actually implement permanently throughout the year. So interesting. This is not just a plucky little startup taking an opportunity to get their employees off of work early. This is a major tech company in Chicago with plans for an IPO that's letting their 1,000 employee workforce off the clock early on Friday. So as the hiring market changes, right, we're going to see companies offer different types of perks, and we'll see if other companies follow suit.
Did you see, speaking of more flexible or employee friendly work policies, have you seen the ad campaign for Heineken where they have a bottle opener? And it's a 30-second ad. I don't exactly understand it, but it sounds like when you use the bottle opener, it automatically turns off work apps. So that when somebody does it, then and everybody in the office going, all right, hey, now they're all popping Heinekens and having a swell time, like on a Friday or maybe a Thursday around noon. I'm not exactly sure what's going on there, but so help me. The bottle opener turns off the apps. It must have a chip in there. I don't know what it does.
I have not seen that ad, but I do like the R&D innovation there.
There's also a story that you wrote. 5 to 9 nearly left Chicago for good. Now it's raised $4.25 million in plans to grow in the city. Just give me the headline on this. What's the company and what's happening there?
Yeah, this is a software firm in Chicago raised, launched by two black women here in the city several years ago. Had a very difficult time raising funding when they first launched in 2018. Left the city. They moved to New York. I came back after one of the founders got into University of Chicago's Booth School and have actually been able to raise $4.25 million. Like you mentioned, one of the largest fundraising rounds led by a black woman in Chicago in recent memory. So a big win in Chicago and one that almost didn't happen in Chicago at all. But the story in Chicago is starting to change a bit. more funding is making its way to Founders of Color in the city, which is certainly a big win for Chicago and a big win for 5-9.
Good to hear you, Jim. Thanks for your help. Let's talk next week.
Thanks, John.
That's Jim Dahlke. You see him as the senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. 12:45, more business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Illinois is trying to get the Asian carp renamed as part of a marketing campaign that will help land the fish in restaurants and on dinner tables. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources will apply to the Food and Drug Administration by the end of the year to have the name change formally approved. IDNR is expected to unveil the new fish name later this week. The agency has a budget of more than $500,000 to change negative views about Asian carp. Cranes reports that effort includes hiring a sales team to hook restaurants, retailers, and distributors. It's hoped increasing demand for the fish will get more commercial fishermen out to lessen the population of the invasive species. A developer has plans to build more than 2,200 apartments and a hotel on sites located between Fulton Market District and the proposed new Bally's Casino in Chicago. Shapack Partners has submitted zoning applications to the Chicago City Council for developments along Grand Avenue between Des Plaines Street and Union Avenue. According to Cranes, the proposal includes an 1,100-unit apartment building and a 141-room hotel. Another proposal near Milwaukee and Union and Hubbard Street includes three buildings with 1,159 residential units, retail, and office space. Added all together, it would create a new downtown neighborhood. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time with Steve Alexander.
Happy Monday to you. June Dairy Month continues, and today is National Ice Cream Soda Day. It is also Vanilla Milkshake Day. We are sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDrivesChicago.com. We are visiting again today with Ukrainian farmer Nick Gordichuk, who has chatted with us a couple of times before about conditions in his area, which is near Kyiv. And Nick, if you don't mind, tell us again about your operation.
Yeah, we are. I have a farm of 600 hectares.
And that's about 1,500 acres.
We are focusing mainly on seed potatoes and table potatoes. And as well, for crop rotation, we are growing winter wheat. We are growing sunflowers and millet.
And when we talked about 6 weeks ago, Nick, you had just finished cleaning your fields, getting the rockets, the Russian rockets and war debris out of there. Were you able to get your planting done?
Yes, Steve. We were lucky that we had no mines on our fields. Some farmers did have, and it takes longer for them to clean their fields. So we were just 2 weeks late when it comes to the planting schedule. In total, we were able to, I would say, plant 350 hectares, and that's out of 600 hectares. And now we are spraying, taking care of the crops. But of course, the challenges are still there. Many farmers were not able, for example, my neighbors were not able to collect the rocket fragments from the fields of winter wheat. So now winter wheat is quite high, and no harvester or no combine driver will agree to go into those fields and to harvest the wheat, because in the wheat you cannot see the fragments or rocket fragments.
And if a combine picked up one of those fragments, best case is it would damage the combine, and worst case is it could still be a live rocket and it could blow up the whole thing, including the driver and anybody else nearby. What about getting last year's crop to market? That was a problem you talked about before.
We still have problems with logistics of grain. And this is going to be the biggest problem for Ukraine and for Ukrainian agriculture now.
And Nick will talk more about that and other issues tomorrow. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's go to the movies, Amy. What's the latest on how the weekend went?
Indeed. So the Lightyear, the new Pixar movie in the Toy Story franchise, rather, it did $51 million in the domestic opening. It did almost $35 million in ticket sales outside of the U.S., so about $85 million globally. But believe it or not, that's actually not even anywhere close to expectations. That was certainly falling short. Toy Story 4 was in 2019. That was $120 million. And then in 2010, the third one in the series was $110 million. So given those numbers, kind of it's the question of why it came in, a lot shorter than expectations. And a couple of different outlets have reported on this, but some reporting in CNBC had indicated that, maybe it has to do with some of the competition right now. There's Jurassic World, that was a 58 58.6, almost 59 million opening weekend. Of course, Top Gun, that was another 44 million this weekend on top of a big opening weekend. So it could be that it's just kind of about competition, that people aren't going to the movies as much. But nonetheless, this was still the best performance of an animated feature since the start of the pandemic.
Well, I guess that's good news. Everybody I know that's talking about going to a movie, granted, maybe they don't have small children, but everybody's still jacked about the Tom Cruise Maverick movie. That's the one folks still want to see.
Yeah, certainly.
And it's fantastic. Talk to me about air travel. What's the latest?
Yeah, so another really rough weekend. We saw a little bit of delays over Memorial Day weekend. And then later this past week, of course, big storms rolled through here, Chicago being a big hub. Those storms rolled on and hit other big air travel hubs. So we saw a lot of delays. We saw about 6,500 flights canceled between Thursday and Friday. On Sunday, we saw another 6,000 around the globe that were canceled. So it's another kind of more of the same. Right, where we see understaffing issues because so many airlines had to offer buyouts and furloughs and lay people off during earlier parts of the pandemic. And then it takes time to rehire and retrain that staff. So you don't have all the crews, all the planes are not yet in service from 2019. That said, traffic is only about 12% below 2019 levels at this point. So it's up there. 2.4 million travelers were screened by the TSA at U.S. airports just on Friday alone. That's a big number. I remember when we hit 1 million about a year ago, that was a very big deal because travel had just taken such a hit in earlier parts of the pandemic. So it's still kind of creeping up. That demand is still there, not quite up as high as it was pre-pandemic. But nonetheless, when conditions are just this tight, right, when you don't have that many crews, when the schedules are really tight, it really only takes a band of really rough weather to set off a lot of issues and a lot of delays. I mean, that is a huge number. When you're talking over 6,000 flights, I mean, that's really 5% of U.S. flights. So it's not like a whopping number, but it's still quite a bit when airlines are really trying so hard to recover from all that revenue they lost over the last couple of years.
DuSable Museum is changing its name.
Yes, that's right. It's a subtle tweak, but there's also going to be a rebrand with it. So the DuSable Museum of African American History will now be known as the DuSable Black History Museum and Education Center. There was a big weekend celebration, and it was free admission and a big barbecue and block party, and Chance the Rapper was there to kind of unveil this new name. And there's a new logo and kind of a new look on the website now. And it's really kind of emphasizing the do part of DuSable, kind of trying to do a play on words about making this action verb and moving into this educational space and really about movement there. It's really interesting.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, it sounds like it's not only a good idea, but timely to mention that today.